The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Ron McFarlane is a Grammy-nominated musician. He plays lute, and in addition to his solo work, he is also a founding member of Baltimore Consort and a new group, Earhart. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to go back to real basics. I want you to explain what a lute is. You know, I think people have probably seen pictures of, you know, angels playing them and all of that sort of thing, but talk about what the instrument actually is and maybe give a little bit of its history.
Sure. The lute is actually derived from the Arabic oud. And during the Middle Ages, crusaders went to the Middle East and fought their fights and brought back, well, souvenirs. And among those were lutes, or rather ouds at the time. They brought these, the oud, which had the rounded back, the pear-shaped body, the bent back peg box, and a few strings strung across a neck. And in medieval times, European musicians began playing the oud. And as the years went by, it gradually evolved into a separate instrument that Europeans called the lute. So gradually, they added more and more strings, began to make it lighter, and then also, beginning around the end of medieval times, the beginning of the Renaissance, began playing it with their fingertips rather than with a plectrum. It had been played with a quill, usually an eagle's feather being the preferred quill throughout the medieval times. But in the Renaissance, the new finger style of playing made it possible to play polyphony. And it was at that time, starting right around 1500 or so, that the lute kind of exploded in popularity and became the most popular of all instruments in the Renaissance. So it's from that time, as well as medieval times, that we see a lot of paintings, woodcuts, and other depictions of people playing the lute, of angels flying through the air playing the lute. That's my favorite lute-holding position, is flying through the air. And the lute gradually gained more and more strings. Through the Renaissance, it was strung in pairs of strings, so that you usually had a single treble and at least five pairs beyond that as a standard Renaissance lute. That would be 11 strings. But by the 17th and 18th centuries, you would have as many as 24 strings total arranged into 13 courses in Germany, and even 28 arranged into 14 courses in Italy. So you have an enormous range of different numbers of stringings and styles of lute throughout its history, going from medieval times right up until the end of the 18th century.
And of course, there are all these different kinds of lutes, some of them like the theorbo, you know, this enormous instrument,
right.
Very, very unusual looking and very different.
Yes, the theorbo, kind of an offshoot of the lute, might be thought of as kind of a bass lute, but it was created mainly as an accompanying instrument and became popular starting around 1600, primarily to accompany the voice in the new style of monody. It was thought to be an ideal accompaniment for the voice because it could change its volume, it could change its tone color, and phrase by phrase, it was able to shape the music more intimately than other instruments along with the voice.
Hmm. So who would be some of the composers, the main composers writing lute music in the golden age of the lute?
Well, I think first of all, you would have to say John Dowland, who was not Queen Elizabeth's favorite, but he was the dominant composer at the time that Queen Elizabeth and Shakespeare were living their lives. Prior to that, Francesco da Milano, an Italian at the beginning of the 16th century, was a wonderful composer and lutenist to three successive popes, which was a very good job for a lute player back at that time. Mm. Albert de Riep, who was a lutenist to Francois I, was perhaps the most highly rewarded lutenist in history, who was given, I believe he was even given a castle and given money and lands. Mm. And it would sort of be along the lines of having a billionaire lute player nowadays, which is a kind of bizarre thought. But back in the 16th century, they were very highly rewarded and highly valued musicians. Hmm. Then moving to later times, Sylvius Leopold Weiss, who was a friend and colleague of Johann Sebastian Bach, was a giant of 18th century compositions. He composed more than 700 pieces altogether that survive, and just a wonderful corpus of music. So those are some of the stars that I can think of composers of the past.
Hmm. So as one of today's leading lutenists, you were looking to create some new music for the instrument, and I believe that helped lead you to forming the group Earhart. Would you talk a little bit about that?
That's right. You know, I just couldn't help myself. There is so much lute music, between 40 and 50,000 pieces that survive from the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. So there's more than enough music for actually several lifetimes to explore. But I think my love and my respect for the lute, as that deepened, I began to understand it more intimately. I saw and heard the instrument as something that could play not just the old music, but was a very good, sensitive, and articulate vehicle for music of our own time as well. Mm-hmm. And being a 20th and 21st century person, I listened to a lot of music, not just Renaissance and Baroque and medieval music. I love Celtic music. I love jazz. I love folk music in particular, of all different kinds. Mm-hmm. And so as I began writing new music for the lute, I began to think, well, it could really play in a variety of styles. So my first recording of new lute music is called Indigo Road, and that's a recording that I thought was pretty successful in that it explored a variety of styles, a varieties of ways that the lute could be used. And I think a lot of people, myself included, were surprised at the versatility of this instrument.
So tell me a little bit about your colleagues in Earhart.
Oh, yes.
And
yes,
how you met, and you know, kind of what strengths they each bring, because obviously you have a particular perspective and background as well. How do they complement your work?
Well, as I began writing more and more music for the lute, the thoughts that I had for the music went beyond what a single lute could play, and I began being interested in having a singer sing some songs and having other instruments mm-hmm. along with me. So I suppose, first of all, I came across a bass player, Willard Morris, who plays fretless electric bass, but he also plays the calascione, which is a kind of bass lute. And he also plays violin, has had a background in jazz and classical music, and he was really game for trying many of the things that I wanted to try with the lute. After that, Matthias Rook, who is a percussionist, he was both a jazz drummer but also a hand percussionist, very interested in world music and also very interested in my experiments with the lute. Mm-hmm. I think having the bass and percussion complemented the sound quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Mindy Rosenfeld from the Baltimore Consort, who's our flute player, played flute on a number of tracks on the first Earhart recording and also on Indigo Road. And she also plays harp, which fills out the sound considerably. And Earhart also worked with a couple of female singers, It really didn't work out because they ended living on different continents. So we couldn't quite hold that together. But a younger colleague of mine, Brian Kay, who's a lutenist and singer, joined Erhard in 2013. And I think the group really became itself at that point. Mindy wasn't able to continue playing with us because of the group being bicoastal, Mindy living in California, mm-hmm. and Erhard being in the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. area. Mm-hmm. So we really are a quartet now, with Brian singing, playing lute. He also plays guitar and a variety of other instruments. Mm-hmm. Willard playing calacione, a kind of bass lute, and also bass and violin. And Matthias playing more percussion instruments than I can count. And again, it creates a great variety of sound and allows you to hear the lute in a variety of contexts.
So for Barley Moon, I mean, as you know, as I'm listening to you talk, it sort of all makes sense. It kind of clicks into focus because it's very modern sounding. And yet some of the music is Renaissance music. How did that all kind of come together?
I think, first of all, our first album was an album of original music. Mm-hmm. But in Barley Moon, we're going to all old music. Mm-hmm. And yet we wanted to explore the intersection of folk music and art music at the time. It's something that's always interested me. Mm-hmm. So in this, we have about half the tracks by William Byrd and John Dowland, and about the other half are folk tunes from that same time. In the case of John Barleycorn, that's a folk tune going back to the 16th century, but I first heard it in 1970 when the rock band Traffic had an album called John Barleycorn Must Die, and Steve Winwood was singing it. Mm-hmm. Now, I was in high school at that time, and I had no idea that it was an old tune. It was just a rock song that I liked very much and played over and over again. And it was only decades later that I learned that that song had a long history. And when I went back to the old sources, I saw that Steve Winwood was indeed singing the right tune. They really didn't do very much to it other than play it on a modern steel string guitar, on modern flute and percussion and so forth. What we did was we tried to bring it back to its Renaissance roots. So we're playing it on a couple of lutes, calacione, and hand percussion. But the energy of the song, the propulsion in the song, will sound very familiar and has very much a folk music feel about it. Mm-hmm. Now, another song, In a Garden So Green, might be thought of as an art song. That's one that goes back to the 17th century in Scotland. But again, it sort of lives on the borderline between art song and folk music. And it's not fully arranged in its old version. You find it in a Musica Britannica, ancient music of Scotland. And it's a wonderful tune, yet it's unharmonized, and it leaves us a lot of leeway to create our own arrangements. Mm-hmm. A song like Fortune My Foe, I think, is a good example, because Fortune My Foe was a kind of dark ballad tune. It was actually sung at executions in Elizabethan England. And so here we have a ballad tune with many, many verses. We don't really sing all the verses here, but we present it, first of all, in its completely unadorned, unaccompanied form. So you'll hear Brian singing the first verse of Fortune My Foe all by himself. Then on the second verse, a rather spare accompaniment, but using the chords that John Dowland used to accompany it. Then the next time through, you'll hear John Dowland's own very artful, sophisticated arrangement of this old folk or ballad tune. And then gradually, as the verses go by, it goes back again into a more folk or unadorned version. So within the single song, you hear the evolution of it going from an unaccompanied ballad tune to something that was created or constructed by a very artful composer, mm-hmm. and then once again going back to its roots. Mm-hmm. And I think that's emblematic of what we're doing in this recording. Again, trying to show how the folk music and the art music coexisted and blended together at this time.
I have to go back to something you mentioned before, and just the reference to your colleagues in Earhart and their sort of diverse backgrounds in different genres and their fondness and expertise in these other genres. And you too, I know, have a more diverse background than just playing Renaissance music or music you've composed for the lutes. You're a guitarist as well.
Right.
And there's a little bit of rock and roll in your background, like it seems just about every lutenist I've ever spoken with has.
That's pretty common among lute players. There aren't many kids, especially from my generation, who grew up going, I want to be a lute player. I had no idea what a lute was even. Mm-hmm. But I knew what rock and roll was as a mm-hmm. teenager. Mm-hmm. And while I had piano lessons and even drum lessons, I really caught a fever for music, I think at age 13, when I heard a rock band of my classmates playing the Surfaris hit called Wipeout. You remember Wipeout?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so this is from the 1960s. And I'm sure it was horrible, but to my 13-year-old ears, I thought it was wonderful. And I immediately had to get a guitar. And, you know, not many things in my life have turned on a dime. Most things just happen gradually. But that's one instance where I can say, from that moment, I was just on fire with love and passion for music, and I've just found it the most fun thing that I could do. That I wanted nothing more than to play guitar and practice guitar at that time, and that's continued until now. I've always enjoyed music tremendously. Mm. So I went from the 13-year-old rock player I began to study classical guitar a bit. I thought it would improve my rock playing. I suppose it did. But I really fell in love with classical music. And I went to school to a couple of conservatories, Shenandoah Conservatory and Peabody Conservatory in Baltimore, for classical guitar. But more and more, what I loved about the classical guitar music that I was playing was the Renaissance and Baroque music. Music that had originally been lute music that then was arranged for guitar. So I became curious about what it would sound like to feel a lute and to play that same music on a lute. And I got a lute, tried it out, and within 6 months I had switched over to playing exclusively lute because I just loved its music so much.
Hmm. Do you still play guitar at all?
Not in public. I have an electric guitar, a Fender Stratocaster that I've knocked around on from time to time. Mm-hmm. But I think I'll be giving it to my teenage son and let him carry on that particular tradition.
Let him catch on fire for it himself.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you kind of came along. I mean, really sort of the first big revival of Baroque and early music was kind of the middle of the 20th century. And you kind of came along at that second wave, that second generation.
Yes.
And I'm curious to know what changes you've seen, what improvements, maybe what things you haven't liked so much. Or how do you think that acceptance of interest in and the world of Baroque and early music has changed in the time that you've been involved?
If you listen to the radio, there's an enormous change. I think when I first became interested, a radio announcer would mention and make particular mention if a piece of music was played on original instruments. And now it's just expected. Mm-hmm. If you hear, say, Elliot Gardner or, you know, any number of Baroque orchestras, mm-hmm. There's generally not even any mention of the fact that it's played on original instruments. Mm-hmm. You might mention if it's being played on modern instruments. Mm-hmm. I think Baroque music in particular has come to the fore in festivals, and you see much more Baroque music in concert series and being played at a much higher level than it was decades ago. Mm. I'm seeing perhaps less Renaissance and medieval music, and I would love to see and hear more of those genres as well in live concerts and in recordings. But mm-hmm. there are wonderful players and scholars in those periods as well. Also in music schools, you can major in early music instruments at a number of music schools now, and you could not a few decades ago. Mm-hmm. Peabody Conservatory has a wonderful early music department. Juilliard, in particular for Baroque music. In Indiana, you have the early music school there. I think for my generation, most people probably went to Europe to go to perhaps the Schola Cantorum mm-hmm. In Basel if they wanted to study exclusively old music. So it's really grown tremendously. I'd love to see it and hear it grow more, but those are some of my observations. Oh, one other thing is the instruments themselves and reproductions of instruments have improved just enormously in that time. Mm-hmm. The lutes and other instruments that one can get are, I think, just first rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd love to get your take on something that I often will ask people who are, you know, kind of in the heart and soul of playing early music. And there just seems to be something inherently appealing about Baroque and early music for people who are not necessarily classical music lovers. You know, people sort of stumble on it. I find it true with a number of Sunday Baroque listeners. It's sort of one of the common comments I get from listeners. They say, you know, I don't really know anything about music. I've never really listened to it, but there's something about the Baroque and early music that just speaks to me. And I'm just sort of curious to know if you have any opinion on that. I'm not going to hold you to it as fact or scientific research, but just I'm wondering if you have a gut feel for what that, no pun intended about gut, but if you have any kind of opinion about why that might be. What is it that is appealing about this music to people who don't even necessarily have a classical music orientation?
I'll tell you a bit about my own experience. Is that when I did play in rock bands, not just in high school, but also in college. It was my weekend job. It was my summer job when I was studying classical guitar. And so I continued playing music that nowadays is called classic rock. Mm-hmm. And it was covers of tunes by the Rolling Stones, Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, and so forth. So that became kind of my native language. So I got used to improvising. I got used to playing in certain modes as well. Not so much major and minor, but a lot of the scales for blues music are more along the lines of Dorian scales and Mixolydian scales. So when I began hearing Renaissance music in particular and some of the folk music from that time, I felt and heard a direct connection between my playing of rock and roll and this kind of music, which also gave the chance for on-the-spot improvisation. The popular music and dance music have a sort of rhythmic vitality that also is mirrored between between that old music and the rock music that I was playing. Besides that, you have a kind of directness of expression. It can be very beautiful, it can be very sophisticated, but there's something very direct about rock music and folk music and about a lot of the early music that I'm interested in playing. This is particularly, say, music from the Elizabethan times and the folk music from England in the 17th century. All those things connected with my rock and roll background in a way that just felt very organic and natural. I felt like I understood it intuitively without needing to have a classical music education. Mm. And even though I did have a classical music education, it didn't keep me from enjoying it just as much. You can appreciate music on many different levels. Mm. But as you said, it was kind of a gut level. It was a kind of intuitive, organic enjoyment of the music for me. So I think it just connected with some of the earliest music that I had played back in high school in my college days. Hmm. And that sort of visceral enjoyment has just never gone away. I think I hear less of that connection in Baroque music, although a lot of Baroque music is wonderfully rhythmically propulsive. But I have I love Baroque music absolutely as much as the earlier music, and I play it on the lute, even though I don't play it in ensembles as much.
So what's next for you? What other projects are you planning at this point?
Well, for my solo projects, the next recording will be of Irish and Scottish music. I have a couple of Scottish music recordings already, but this one will be a recording of primarily 17th and 18th century tunes. Some of them will be tunes of Turlough O'Carolan. Many of them will be fiddle tunes, and they're all my arrangements for the Baroque lute. And we'll be recording that in the spring. Earhart, on the other hand, will be working on a John Dowland project, and also on another project called Centuries Collide, in which we'll have old music and also some new music together in the same concert program and same recording. Mm. So those are some new things. The last thing that's come out, of course, is Earhart's Barley Moon, which explores a passion of mine, as we said before, which is art music and folk music and how they connect and interact with one another.
Hmm. Well, I am looking forward to hearing these and sharing them with Sunday Baroque listeners. It's wonderful. And I cannot thank you enough for making time to chat today and for sharing these wonderful insights. It was great.
It has been a great enjoyment.